This is the State of Things, broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. The Democratic National Convention is underway and making history. Last night, on a virtual roll call vote featuring a live mix of pre-taped videos from 57 states and territories, showcased a wide variety of voices from a firefighter in Connecticut to a tribal activist in South Dakota. The delegate votes tallied up to make former Vice President Joe Biden the Democratic nominee for president, which means his historic vice presidential pick is also official. California Senator Kamala Harris is the first black woman and first Asian American person to be a major party's nominee for vice president. We're going to talk about that and more today on Back Channel, our series connecting culture and context. Also going to look at a new HBO documentary that recalls a 1989 murder that seems all too familiar today. And we break down Beyoncé's latest work of art, Black is King. With me are popular culture experts Natalie Bullock Brown and Mark Anthony Neal. Natalie is a filmmaker and teaching assistant professor at North Carolina State University. Welcome back, Natalie.
Thanks, Frank.
Mark, James B. Duke professor and chair of the Department of African and African American Studies at Duke University. He's an author and the host of the webcast Left of Black. Welcome, Mark.
Hey, what's up, Frank?
Lots to talk about today. Natalie, let's go back talking about the convention, but let's go back to the announcement by Joe Biden that Kamala Harris would be his vice presidential pick. What was your reaction?
It was sort of mixed. I had really been wondering whether or not Biden would actually make good on the promise of selecting a woman, let alone a black woman, for his VP pick. And I was thinking that Susan Rice, because of her experience with the Obama administration, and also the fact that from all accounts, she's fairly centrist, you know, that she would be probably the best pick, or that she would be the likely pick. So when he selected Kamala, I was surprised, but I think pleasantly so, because to me, Kamala, even though I have some reservations about her time as a DA in California, I think that she is evolving, and I think that there is a way that, because of how she identifies, not only as a black woman, but also as an Indian American woman, I think that she really represents and embodies this idea of a big tent. And Joe Biden was not going to get that sort of representation, really, or symbolism, even if he had picked a white woman, or certainly a white man. So I think he did good, and I'm excited in part about Kamala because she's a Howard alum, and so am I. So, you know, what can't you love about that?
There you go. Well, Mark, what apart from her alma mater, what else do you think Joe Biden was looking at in her resume and in who she is? Give us a sense of who she is and why that might be a good choice for Joe Biden.
I think for a vice presidential candidate, you're always looking up to shore off the base to get some excitement on the ticket, particularly if there isn't excitement about the top of the ticket from a particular base of voters. So he really had to pick something that was going to energize black women and the black electorate in general. You know, Karen Bass was probably too far to the left. Stacey Abrams was probably not enough of a known entity nationally. The same could be said about, Mayor Keisha Lance in Atlanta. And so I, like Natalie, thought it would either be Kamala Harris or would be Susan Rice. I think Susan Rice on some level is more of an unknown and that people don't know a great deal about her per se. You know, obviously her new memoir helped in that regard. And so in some ways I kind of expected it to be Kamala Harris, right? She was centrist enough. She was someone, because of her prosecutorial background, would be seen as helpful on questions about, you know, policing. In some ways, in ways that centrist Democrats would be interested, the blue dogs, if you will. And I think the fact that she was an HBCU graduate, and I think even probably more importantly, that, you know, she's a member of the Divine Nine, right? Alpha Kappa Alpha sorority. you know, that has its own, the D9 individually and AKA specifically, has its own mechanisms to generate attention towards things. You know, obviously it didn't help her during the primary, but I think to be able to engage that particular populace will be very helpful going forward in terms of folks getting out to vote.
And the political pedigree. I mean, let's not forget that she is a successful politician, right? Elected district attorney of San Francisco, elected as the district attorney general in the state of North Carolina, and then to the U.S. Senate. So she can get elected. And here she is talking about all of that, not only electability, but also the sort of identity and what she brings. Senator Kamala Harris talking to the nonprofit news organization The 19th, and she's answering a question about what it does for the American imagination to see someone with a background like hers as a vice presidential candidate.
I am not unique. There are a lot of people like me. There are a lot of folks where I come from. I come from people. And that is part of the point. Maybe it is for some to stimulate their imagination, but for others, what we know is that this is actually who we are and what we are. And it is a statement that is an affirmation about who we truly are. And this in the face of the current president of the United States, who has spent full time trying to sow hate and division in our country.
Senator Kamala Harris talking to the 19th. It's Back Channel Today. Mark Anthony Neal and Natalie Bullock Brown. Natalie, what do we leave out, do you think, in when we talk about Kamala's identity?
What do we leave out?
Yeah.
What do you mean?
Well, I mean, as you know, I know that you've talked about the fact that as an Indian American, South Asian, that there's another aspect to her identity. And it's one of the things we get caught up in the kind of black-white dyad in the United States. And so we leave out so much when we talk about identity that there's, you know, it's a much more complicated picture and could work to her advantage.
Yeah. I think something that I saw on Facebook earlier today sort of sums up the idea of what might be left out. And basically what I saw was, you know, a quote from Kamala herself that basically, I think she was addressing young girls, young black girls in particular. And she was saying, you know, don't let anyone else define you. You define yourself for them. And I think that's, you know, a lesson for the ages, and especially given the presence of someone like Kamala Harris on the political stage. I think there's a way that we instinctively sort of decide that we know who she is, that we know what she's about. And I think this is an opportunity for us to back up off of that idea and to really sort of be open to all the possibilities, you know, that she sort of alluded to in the bite that we heard.
Right, including,
you know, there's a lot. Go ahead.
Well, forgive me, but including the issues, which is something she addressed herself on the 19th. He's answering a question about whether or not her candidacy will bring more black women to the polls.
Listen, black women pay attention to the issues. Black women are motivated to vote for the people who represent their priorities and their needs. And so when you look at everything that relates to what we have discussed in terms of childcare, when you look at what we are talking about in terms of jobs, when you talk about healthcare, when you look at what we need to do to address racial, not only disparities, right, in terms of the healthcare system, in terms of the economy, in terms of the education system, but what we need to do to also speak about systemic racism, when you have one ticket that can say the phrase Black Lives Matter, and another who has been full-time sowing hate and division in our country, those are the things that are going to motivate black women to vote. There will be a point of pride. You don't want to have any false modesty about a black woman being on the ticket, but it takes more than just that to motivate black women to vote.
Senator Kamala Harris, vice presidential candidate now on the Joe Biden-Harris ticket, but certainly seen as a centrist and as an establishment candidate. Talk about the not-so-establishment candidate, the victory of Cori Bush in the primary to go on and most likely win her congressional seat in Missouri, Mark.
Yeah, you know, and I think there are a couple of things here that I would want to throw in, and even to go back to Kamala Harris for a moment. I think when we talk about national politics, you know, we can't divorce the fact that from the fact that the two black folks who have been nominated on these national tickets are both of mixed race heritage, right? In the case of Barack Obama having, you know, a black mother, in the case of Kamala Harris, obviously having an Indian parent, and in the case of even Kamala Harris and Susan Rice, the fact that they were both married are both married to white men, I don't think that's insignificant. I think we see something play out very differently, obviously, on the local level, right? And on the local level is really where we see electoral opportunities that really challenge the status quo. What's significant about Cori Bush, obviously, in terms of her connection to Black Lives Matter, and there's some folks who will say that this is the maturation of Black Lives Matter. I think if we go back and actually think about it as a movement, you know, having elected officials that could rep Black Lives Matter was always an end game for them. They chose very different kinds of strategies, different platforms. So some folks will be in the street. Some folks will try to be elected to Congress and the mayor and the city council and what have you. What is important is this reminder that there's always this moment where Black folks decide, even when they have Black representation, that that Black representation represents too much of the status quo, and it needs to be a break with the status quo. And that's what we really saw in that primary win for Ms. Bush.
Mark Anthony Neal, James B. Duke Professor and Chair of the Department of African and African American Studies at Duke University. Natalie Bullock Brown, filmmaker and teaching assistant professor at North Carolina State. Our conversations on Back Channel will continue in a moment on the state of things from North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. Please stay tuned. This is the State of Things broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. COVID-19 in colleges is dominating the headlines in North Carolina right now. UNC Chapel Hill, of course, starts all virtual learning today after 1 week of in-person classes. University officials made the call after 130 students tested positive in just 1 week. And yesterday, Appalachian State University announced a COVID-19 cluster there is linked to the football team. They've suspended practices indefinitely. And despite the risks of playing a full contact sport during a pandemic, six college football conferences are moving forward with the fall season, including the ACC, which is the conference that includes UNC Chapel Hill, Duke, NC State, and Wake Forest. So what does that mean for athletes? Mark Anthony Neal and Natalie Bullock Brown are with me to talk about it today on Back Channel. Mark, what is this? Where does this leave college athletes?
You know, football, college football in particular, is a big money sport. It's not surprising that, you know, conferences like the Big 12 and the SEC, given how important teams like Alabama, for instance, are to the SEC, are hedging their bets at the moment that something can actually occur. You know, it might seem surprising that the ACC is taking that route, but, you know, when you consider the influence that Clemson, you know, as a former national champion in recent years has on that, it's not surprising also. It just seems absurd on so many different levels, right? Given the nature of the sport, you know, we were joking in our pre-production conversations, like, has anybody ever watched a football game? You know, so there's no way to social distance in a football game, right? It's a sport that calls into question why we're doing it in the best of times, you know, let alone in the midst of a pandemic. And we can't forget that for many of these top football teams, it's a gateway to professional sports, mainly for African-American athletes who not only carrying the brunt of it in a normal situation are now also at risk given the pandemic and their families. And it just seems ridiculous for us to be going forward.
Well, that's the koan that is the pandemic, right? The way in which all of these things are so paradoxically entwined that the one way to get some footing in this economy for at least a certain subset of the population is to make it through athletics, which has become an economic dynamo for schools. Another question, how did that ever happen and why? But now that you're there, what do you do in a pandemic where the whole job is to stay 2 inches away from another person face to face and breathe heavily in their face and grasp them in an embrace? So, you know, but two of the most powerful college conferences decided to postpone their seasons, Pac-12 and the Big Ten. Natalie, what do you make of all this?
You know, I think that I agree with everything that Mark said, and I think that it is, it's a good thing, certainly, that at least two conferences decided not to move forward. I mean, I think that there is a way that, you know, as the saying goes, the fish rots from the head, right? And the fact that we have a leader in the form of Donald Trump, who has been, downplaying to a large extent the pandemic. And as a result, almost 200,000 people have died. Like, you know, we might as well just go ahead and round that up. And it is what it is, in his own words. You know, that, I think, has set a tone for the way that everyone else has thought about, you know, whether or not we need to put the health and well-being of people over economic considerations. And again, it's great that the Pac-12 and Big Ten decided that they're not going to pursue their seasons. But I think it's absolutely significant and a reflection of this, you know, this greater tone that's been set, that not only are other conferences deciding to play, but universities are trying to open and so forth. It's just, it's really a mess.
Well, Mark, it's not, as you pointed out, it's not just the universities that have become dependent on this economically. On Sunday, Ohio State quarterback Justin Fields started a petition to ask the Big Ten, which has suspended its season, to reinstate the 2020 college football season. So here's a player saying, look, let us play. I mean, what do you make of that?
You know, this is the reality, right? We've allowed collegiate athletics and collegiate athletes to be redefined as essential workers, for lack of a better way to describe it. And the same way that we've seen, you know, working class essential workers feel the need to have to go back into restaurants, into hospitals, into meat packing plants because they need to be able to provide for their family, it's not surprising that you would have 19, 20, 21-year-old athletes, in this case a black athlete, you know, who would ask for, you know, the season to continue because it was their pathway, you know, through collegiate sports in terms of the scholarship and then on to the pro leagues for them to be able to take care of their families. And this is something that's at risk at this point in time. You know, as you mentioned, Frank, you know, it really is a larger indictment, right, of society and how we function for so long. But the idea that we would turn 19 and 20-year-olds, right, into these gladiators, you know, so that we could have the benefit of watching them and enjoying them, consuming them on television, and for these individual universities and television networks to be able to make money off it. It's just absolutely absurd at this point in time.
Well, I want to turn now to college basketball because the big news last month was that five-star forward Makur Maker chose Howard University. I think because, Natalie, you went there. I think that's why. That's what he said. He said, well, Natalie Bully Brown went there. Why wouldn't I go there? And they said, well, you play basketball. But no, he was considering UCLA, Kentucky, and Memphis. So here's a clip of him on ESPN talking about what he hopes his choice to go to Howard University does for HBCUs.
You know, what I've done, I didn't realize it because I thought it was unknown for people to go to HBCUs. You know, it's crazy to know that in 40 years, a five-star recruit hasn't been to a HBCU, but I definitely think it's going to generate a lot of wealth towards our people. You know, it's the place I make the TV exposure. It's the place I make these deals. But, you know, going here is definitely something for top recruits to definitely consider seriously, going to HBCU. You know, when I was on campus, I was kind of stunned. It was during a homecoming weekend, and everything just kicked in.
That's basketball player Makur Maker talking on ESPN. By the way, Mark and Natalie, we've decided next time I'm going to actually run music under our whole show. Just because that's what they do on ESPN, and it's so cool to listen to what somebody's saying seriously with just random music. Anyway, but let's talk seriously about, because it's a very serious, I mean, and I don't mean to make light of that. I wonder why they do that. But it's a really important issue and a stunning decision for Makur Maker, who, you know, probably doesn't sacrifice his NBA career, but a lot of perks along the way in his college career. Talking to Mark Anthony Neal and Natalie Bullock Brown. Mark, what do you make of the news?
I think it's great to hear. Obviously, it's always been a legacy of HBCU collegiate sports that translated into folks, you know, coming into the league, you know, largely because they couldn't go to white institutions. I think everything that's going on and how athletes are being concerned about how they're being exploited, black athletes are being exploited, some of these PWIs, it's natural, given everything that we've seen play out this year, and particularly, you know, in the late spring, that athletes are rethinking some of their decisions. Now, you know, and in some cases, these athletes will be sacrificial lambs, right? They're going to institutions, in some cases, that don't really have the infrastructure in place to compete with some of these schools. But once these top players go to these institutions, and then the television money follows them to those institutions, and all kinds of other investments that do, then the infrastructure will come up to pace also. I'm excited about this particular moment, right? Because in some ways, we've always thought about it, whether we're talking about athletics or even in terms of scholars, that there's always been a brain drain away from the Black community. And one of the ways in which that brain drain could be addressed is being able to work and contribute at Black institutions of higher education.
Natalie, what do you think? What do you think this could do for HBCUs?
Well, I mean, I hope that there will be other players that follow Maker McClure's lead, you know, and I want to just, you know, give big ups to Jemele Hill, because we talked about the fact that last year she made a call for Black athletes to, you know, to do essentially what is being done right now, you know, with this move to Howard. Black athletes should take their talent to HBCUs and to invest not only in their futures in this way, but also in the futures of these schools that are, you know, very much at risk in this moment. So I think it's an amazing thing. I just hope that there will be more athletes who are inspired to follow McClure's lead.
Let's talk about the HBO release, a new documentary last week that details the 1989 murder of Yusuf Hawkins. 16-year-old was shot in Brooklyn when he and some friends went to a predominantly white neighborhood to look at a used car. Yusuf Hawkins, Storm Over Brooklyn, talks to the teen's family and friends about the impact of the murder. It looks at the series of protests led by the Reverend Al Sharpton in the wake of that tragedy, and it also explores larger forces at play in New York in the late 80s and 90s. Mark, set the scene for us.
You know, we talk about a Trayvon generation now in relationship to the late Trayvon Martin. In the late 1980s, we talked about a Yusuf generation, the Yusuf Hawkins generation. You know, this is New York City in ways that we think about New York City as being this melting pot, as David Dinkins says in the documentary, as this kind of cosmopolitan space. You know, but for some Black folks in some of the boroughs, Brooklyn being among them, and some of the neighborhoods in these boroughs, you know, this was a very dangerous time in terms of racial violence. We go back to 1983 and think about the police killing of Michael Stewart in a New York City subway, the killing of Eleanor Bumpers by, you know, New York City Housing Police, you know, the mob that attacks Michael Griffiths that leads to his death being hit by a car on a major thoroughfare in Brooklyn. And then, of course, there's the Yusuf Hawkins moment, right? So Yusuf Hawkins' death is a culmination of all of these energies that have been taking place. And it's all of these things that introduced the nation in New York City, definitely, you know, to figures like Al Sharpton and C. Vernon Mason, the lawyer, and all these other folks, you know, that were on board to help assist Yusuf Hawkins' family in the midst of this tragedy, right? And this is occurring in the context of a New York City mayoral election in which they would elect the first Black mayor in David Dinkins. It's the same summer, you know, that Spike Lee releases Do the Right Thing. So we're already tense around the issues of race in the city. And then, of course, the soundtrack for that summer was Public Enemy's Fight to Power. It was a different and unique moment. And again, a whole generation of thinkers and activists and writers and filmmakers were born in the moment around Yusuf Hawkins' death.
Natalie, what do you remember about that moment?
You know, I was just thinking that very thing. You know, I was a sophomore or a junior in college. And, you know, there were quite a few people from New York who were at Northwestern with me at that time. And I'm thinking about one of my friends in particular. I hope he doesn't mind me calling him out, but Clyde Cole, who wore his hair, you know, he had a high top fade, similar to Yusuf Hawkins. And while I was watching the documentary, all I could think about was Clyde, because, you know, it deeply affected my friends who were from New York, and the guys in particular, because they were familiar with Bensonhurst. They knew a little bit about, you know, they definitely knew something about the racial tensions and how Black folks were being treated in the city, even as they were away from the city, you know, in bucolic Evanston, Illinois. So I remember being affected. I remember, you know, being concerned and sort of, you know, scared even by this thing happening to this young Black man, it was hard to believe that it could happen. But, you know, it was in many ways the beginnings of my political awakening, because, as Mark said, you know, Fight the Power was out, Do the Right Thing was out. You know, this is happening. And there was a lot going on Northwestern's campus politically as well. We were marching on the bursar's office. And I think it was the year that I was actually president of the Black Student Association for members only. So there was a lot happening. It's very interesting that it was sort of a culminating moment when Yousef was killed.
Well, let's hear from the documentary, a clip of Reverend Al Sharpton from Yousef Hawkins' Storm Over Brooklyn.
I had never, I guess maybe because I was born in the North, but I had never seen such unrefined, open hate in my life. Yousef Hawkins took away this veneer they had gotten away with to the world as the cosmopolitan New York.
This is not racist community. We just don't like Black people. That's all.
Rednecks down South are like this. Bensonhurst made people say, what? New York is like that?
Reverend Al Sharpton and the HBO documentary Yousef Hawkins, Storm Over Brooklyn, talking about it on Back Channel today with Mark Anthony Neal and Natalie Bullock Brown. You know, the surprise and the idea that this would happen, Mark, but this is really part of a cycle. And when it becomes known to the American public, it always seems like a one-off. And even in 1989, it was like, oh, that's an extraordinary event. But again, a part of a long history and cycle of events that percolate to the surface and then go back underground, would you say?
Well, there's no question about that. I mean, just in New York City, the aftermath of that, you're dealing with situations where tensions between Black communities and Korean store owners, both in New York but also in L.A. Dinkins loses his reelection campaign to Rudolph Giuliani, who at the time was a U.S. Prosecutor. And it begins Giuliani time, right? Almost rewriting everything that Dinkins tried to do in terms of what he called that golden mosaic in New York City at the time. And when we start to look at the examples of things that happened afterwards, Patrick Dorsman, you know, the killings and shootings by police that occur in New York City in the aftermath, Abner Louima, it seems as though much hadn't changed. And so much to the extent that in at least some of those trials, you know, there was definitely an attempt to push those cases outside of the jurisdiction of New York, you know, in Albany in one of those cases, because, you know, New York had been such a pivotal place for these kind of racial tensions that so many people wanted to deny. But Yousef Hawkins really brought it, that bubbled up in ways that everybody could see what was going on at the time. For me, it's a remembrance that, you know, the first mayoral election that I got to vote on, that I was old enough to vote on in New York City, was to vote for David Dinkins in that primary in September of 1989. And again, as Natalie says, it's the moment where so many of us became engaged, much the way that we see so many young folks now being engaged around Trayvon Martin and Mike Brown and going forward.
Certainly there are similarities, Mark, but I wonder if there are differences or if you see differences as well. Again, given the cyclical nature, you know, some people are radicalized, they're brought to consciousness when these things happen. Are we in a moment when we have to stop explaining to everybody that this is systemic and it wasn't just one thing that happened with a few bad cops or a few wild kids in Bensonhurst? Is that somewhat different, do you think, or are we not there yet?
I think the jury's still out on that, right? We don't know how what we've seen this spring is really going to play out going forward. What I can say about that earlier period of time, you know, there's no social media. The social media at the time is literally what Chuck D said at the time. You know, hip-hop, rap music was the CNN of the ghetto. Young folks were getting their messaging, right, through independent Black newspapers and through rap music. And because you didn't have social media as an outlet, folks had to take to the streets. I mean, the amazing part of that story is watching Al Sharpton and all of those activists, Moses Stewart, you know, Yousef's father, go out there almost two dozen times, right, to march until they have justice. It was a way to connect the old civil rights movement, thinking about the Montgomery bus boycott, to these new politics of the late 20th century.
And how does it relate, do you think, to the Black Lives Matter movement today?
I think there's definitely a connection. I think for folks who are old enough, they can remember how they got energized in that period of time. And then similarly, understand how the Black Lives Movement generation has gotten energized, even if they might disagree with some of the tactics.
Natalie, what about you? What are the parallels or not that struck you as you watched the documentary?
Yeah, I thought a lot about what Mark just mentioned a few moments ago in terms of like the number of times Reverend Sharpton, you know, led marches. I mean, I could not believe, I did not remember that there were more than 10 marches that, you know, took place in Bensonhurst. And it really underscored the fact that, you know, there is a place for that type of activism, for that type of protest, where you march and you roll through someone's neighborhood, you roll up on a governor's mansion, you do what you have to do until there's enough pressure felt for some sort of change to take place. And I think that that is exactly what has been happening and continues to happen today with the protests that were born out of, you know, sheer outrage and frustration over not only George Floyd's murder, but Breonna Taylor's murder, Ahmaud Arbery's murder, you know, so many Black folks have been killed over the past 5 months, you know, just during the pandemic. And, you know, people are still marching. We don't hear about it in the news, but people are still marching in Kentucky.
Well, Natalie, we're going to take a break right now. Natalie Bullock Brown, Mark Anthony Neal. It's Back Channel on the State of Things, and our conversation continues in a moment. Please stay with us. This is the State of Things. I'm Frank Stachow. It's Back Channel Today, our series connecting culture and context. I'm here with Natalie Bullock Brown and Mark Anthony Neal. Natalie's a filmmaker and teaching assistant professor at North Carolina State University. Mark is James B. Duke Professor and Chair of the Department of African and African American Studies at Duke, and author and the host of the webcast Left of Black. So last week, OWN aired the finale, the season finale, in fact, series finale of Greenleaf, a drama that follows the Greenleaf family and their Memphis megachurch with mostly African-American members. The series ran for 5 seasons, and OWN announced there will be a spinoff. Mark, tell us a little bit about the show.
Yeah, Greenleaf, I think, was an important moment in OWN's development in the sense that it was a break editorially with the kind of melodrama that we associate with Tyler Perry on the network. I think people at first were confused about Greenleaf, right? It looked like it could have been a Tyler Perry product. But Greenleaf and Queen Sugar really brought this new era of serious drama on OWN. And it's situated in an institution that everyone has an attachment to and everybody has an opinion to in terms of the Black church. And it celebrated the value of the Black church, particularly in relationship to Black communities and Black relationships. But it also dealt with some of the tensions within Black churches and the flaws of Black churches. One of the lead figures, of course, is Bishop Greenleaf, played by Keith David. And he might be one of the most fully drawn and flawed Black male characters of a certain age that we've seen on television in some time. And for that, that was one of the reasons why I kept going back to the show.
Natalie, what kind of contribution do you think Greenleaf makes to television and particularly Black television in America?
Well, it's the first time I think that the Black church and what would normally be sort of held up as pathologies that swirl around in the Black church is actually treated and represented in a way that has nuance and that gives dignity to the issues I'm talking about. Homophobia and molestation and all kinds of other abuse that, you know, often takes place, certainly not just in the Black church, but that we don't necessarily in Black Christian circles feel comfortable talking about. And certainly there's a sort of misogyny that misogynoir in particular that takes place in the Black church that is often not discussed as well. So I think that's what Greenleaf does so well, and it's why it has been, you know, riding this wave for so long. It the representation matters, and it really does a great job at getting it right.
Well, let's get a sample of the show. Here's a clip from season 5 of Greenleaf. Actress Lynn Whitfield as Lady May, the matriarch of the Greenleaf family.
So before we dive into the memories, and I know that We all have so much to share. I just want to say a few words to honor Bishop's wishes about what is yet to be. I want to talk about the new. Behold, the prophet Isaiah said, speaking for God, I am doing a new thing. Do you not perceive it? And so, church, today, I want us to think together about the new. I want us to dream together today about the new. Not what this church has ever been, but what has never been.
That's a clip from Greenleaf, the OWN drama series that just aired its finale last week after 5 seasons. It's back channel today with Mark Anthony Neal and Natalie Bullock Brown. Mark, actors and producers of that series have said that they hope the show breaks the mold of what people think of a black TV show. Do you think Greenleaf opens up possibilities for other black creators in television?
Absolutely. Look, Lynn Whitfield in her early 1960s is still in her early 60s is still eye candy for me. The fact that you could have a grown black woman still be perceived and presented as desirable, as sexy, as alluring, and all those things, but also intellectually and spiritually powerful. We've seen few images of black women in that role, you know, what Lady May represented on that series. Again, the fact that they were able to build a strong social media following, there's several Greenleaf, you know, Facebook groups that kind of talked ongoing for these 5 or 6 years about, you know, what the show was and what it was hoping to achieve. We saw that kind of engagement with social media with Scandal, and it still resonates for certain black programs. One of the best ways to get people engaged is to build these other platforms and other sites for folks continually to talk about it, because the show is so reflective of what our everyday lives are.
Well, let's dig into Beyonce's latest work, take a little turn here. Her latest work of art, Disney Plus, released her visual album Black is King at the end of July. It's a companion to her 2019 album The Lion King, The Lion King, The Gift. Natalie, how would you describe Black is King?
You know, now this is a mosaic. If we're going to talk about a golden mosaic, I think that Black is King is similar to Lemonade in that it each song flows into the next, and the imagery is vibrant. It's colorful. It's deep. There's a lot of symbolism that I have not fully unpacked that, you know, is presented. But I think the main thing about Black is King is just the richness of representation of blackness, of pride in being black, of the beauty of blackness. And, you know, it just seems to be another step in Beyonce's evolution, as she really seems to be, you know, trying to stretch and grow and present more and more of what feels authentic to her.
Well, and here's Beyonce herself from a message she recorded about Black is King for Good Morning America.
My hope for this film is that it shifts the global perception of the word black, which has always meant inspiration and love and strength and beauty to me. But Black is King means black is regal and rich in history, in purpose, and in lineage. I hope y'all love it. I hope you enjoy it, and I hope y'all see it tonight.
Beyonce promoting her new visual album, Black is King, which Disney Plus released on July 31st. Mark Anthony Neal, did she achieve that goal, do you think?
So you have to start with everything that she's done the last decade or so. That it's absolutely beautiful and it's stunning to look at. It's a visual achievement. Her use of so many different directors, including, you know, the Ghanaian rapper Blitz the Ambassador, who's now a filmmaker. It was important in that regard. But I also worry sometimes in what the film does is really present a Black American portal, you know, into Africa, which I think is critically important this moment of time. But, you know, reading some of the criticism of the piece from African writers, right, you know, or diasporic African writers who are here in the U.S., you know, there's been much more of a critical lens. There's a way in which, you know, folks who are from a country in Africa don't think of themselves as Black. They may not necessarily think of themselves as African. They think about themselves as Ghanaian and Senegalese and Nigerian, and we could go on and on. But I think it does open a portal to having a conversation about what Africa represents to Black Americans in this point in time, even if it may flatten some of our understandings of what Africa and the diversity of Africa is at this moment.
Well, Natalie, let's talk about that. I mean, that was some of the criticism coming from the African continent, that in some ways there are representations that reinforce stereotype and that, you know, create identities that may not be felt on the continent. But there are other criticisms as well. Before the film was even released, Natalie, some were saying Beyoncé was appropriating the culture. Let's talk about that.
Yeah, I mean, I tried to hold off on reading a lot of those critiques until I had seen it myself. But I will say that there is one, it's not really a critique, but it's a sort of an observation that I think is really, really true and about Beyoncé in general, and that fits Black is King. And I think that the idea that we project onto Beyoncé, you know, who we want her to be, who we think she is. I mean, it's kind of coming full circle from Kamala Harris, right? This idea of bestowing upon a Black woman their identity instead of allowing them to self-define. And so I think in many ways, you know, the critiques of Black is King, you know, I can see these issues of appropriation playing out. I'm sure that there's something that could be debated there. But I also think that, you know, I tend to trust that Beyoncé, when she says this is what she's trying to do, that's what she's in fact trying to do with Black is King. I think she's trying to celebrate Blackness in a way that you certainly are not going to see on Disney. And we typically do not see anywhere in popular culture. So I think that, you know, in many ways, we just need to let her do what she does, take it for what it's worth, let it give us whatever it's going to give us and be done with it.
Well, Mark, I want you to talk a little bit about that, too, because I know we've all talked about that on this show, the way popular culture and the demands of popular culture shape the artist, the way the artist can shape the art and the culture and the kind of circle dance that goes on. You know, what's the mix here of culture shaping artist, artist shaping culture in this particular piece, let's say?
You know, it's complex, I think, you know, because one of the things I think we have to admit at this point in time is that Beyoncé as an icon, as a cultural producer, actually takes up a lot of space. To her credit, it's space that she shares with so many other collaborators. But, you know, Natalie is right. We have certain kinds of investment in what we think Bey is going to provide for us in these particular moments. And I think there was this added attention to Black is King because of everything that we've been going through with COVID and the killings and everything else, Breonna Taylor, et cetera, that I really sets us up for certain kind of expectations in Black is King that were never intended to be delivered, right? One, because it was done before this moment even occurred, but also speaks to this investment in us that we have in Beyoncé. You know, to Natalie's point, you know, this is a piece that generated, 1,000 think pieces? and trying to parse through all the kind of critical lens that people provide for it, I'm not sure there should be any singular artist in which we give that kind of attention to. You know, let her create the way that she's going to create, have the vision that she is, but let's open up the space for other visions around. You know, hopefully this will open an opportunity for us actually to see more African artists, filmmakers, musicians, to be able to present their work here in the United States on their own terms.
Well, Natalie and Mark, you have just offered, I think, a perfect example of the kind of nuanced critique that we've been able to do for the past 5 years on Back Channel. Congratulations. It's our fifth anniversary, and you're not here for me to give you a big warm hug and say how great it is, but I'm just thrilled that we've been able to do this for 5 years and a little amazed that it's been that long. So let's take a minute to celebrate not only the segment itself, but our contributors, Natalie Bullock-Brown and Mark Anthony Neal. Mark, any thoughts, reflections, favorite moments, ways to celebrate?
Just the fact that for the last 5 years I've been able to share the mic with Natalie, and most importantly, to learn something in every one of those moments. I think what Natalie and I envisioned when we, you know, first talked with you, Frank, and the State of Things team about this show is that we wanted to create a space that lovingly dealt with Black culture, but that we weren't all rah-rah and yay-yay about it, right? Natalie's still not going to let me live down that, you know, that series that was on Netflix about the Black family that she thought was so tired, right? You know, she's never going to let me live that down. But that's the joy that we've had in doing the program.
Natalie, how about you?
Absolutely. I couldn't agree more. It has been a pleasure and an honor to be able to share the mic with Mark and with you, Frank, and to talk about, you know, issues that and topics that, you know, I wouldn't ordinarily get to talk about in the ways that we have discussed them. I learn something every single time, and I just feel really privileged to have been able to grow in many ways just by participating in this project. So thanks to both of you.
Thanks, and
it doesn't feel like 5 years, Frank. It feels like we just started.
No, it doesn't.
It does because we're and that's it. We're sort of always experimenting to saying, hey, how do we handle this one, and how do you want to talk about that one? So I think it's a great experiment. It's going on, and it would not be as great as it is without the two of you and your thought that goes into not only the planning but then the execution of this amazing segment that has made our air so much better. So thank you both.
Thank you.
Natalie Bullock-Brown, Mark Anthony Neal. Natalie is a filmmaker and teaching assistant professor at North Carolina State. Mark Anthony Neal, James B. Duke Professor and Chair of the Department of African and African American Studies at Duke University. He's an author and the host of the webcast Left to Black. You can find links to their work and what we do at our website, stateofthings.org. State of Things produced by Anita Rao, Amanda Magnus, Grant Hall of Mormon, Kaya Findlay, and Stacia Brown. Jenny Lawson is our technical director. Al Widarski helped engineer the show today. North Carolina Public Radio is a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stacio, and we leave you with Beyonce.
Used to teach me all my dreams.